Come on, come on, come on, come on. Welcome to the Blazers Edge podcast presented to you today by BlazersEdge.com. My name is Chris Lucia. I do the game previews over at Blazers Edge. I also dip my hand in a bit of editing, and I'm proud to announce that I'm the new host of a weekly podcast. This Tuesday, I'm going to be filling in for Dave Deckard and Phil Nasons in their normal spot, but they're going to be back next Tuesday with their podcasts, and I'm going to be releasing episodes closer to the weekend. I will be switching up the format just slightly. I'm going to be bringing on, hopefully, a different guest every week, which means you could be hearing from other Blazers Edge contributors, writers at SB Nation, sister sites of ours, other Blazers personalities and bloggers all together. Essentially, what I want to do is get on a fresh voice as often as I can and break down everything that's going on with the Blazers that week. We'll take a look at both short-term and long-term trends on the court for the Blazers and how those kinds of things affect the team going forward, player personnel moves, anything that pops up off the court for the Blazers during the course of the week. Basically, if you take your typical game analysis, anything that you kind of get a cursory glance of there, we're going to take those things and go a bit more in-depth with them. And so before we go any further, I'd like to let you know I can be reached at blazersedgepodcast@gmail.com. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or ideas regarding the podcast, if you have mailbag questions for Dave and Phil, keep sending those to blazersub@gmail.com, and they'll get you covered on their Tuesday editions of the podcast. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't bring up Blazers Edge Night 2015. It's a cool event that Dave Deckard, the managing editor for BlazersEdge.com, has been putting on for a couple of years now. We put out the call for Blazers Edge readers to raise money, which goes towards tickets for underprivileged youth in the Portland area to get into a Portland Trail Blazers ball game. This year, Dave chose March 30th against the Phoenix Suns. We're trying to raise enough in donations so that we can send upwards of 1,000 kids and their chaperones to the game. If you're interested in getting involved in Blazers Edge Night, visit BlazersEdge.com. I know that all of Dave's posts at the very end have a link to Blazers Edge Night. You can click that, or you can go to any of my previews at the top of the header. The very last link is for Blazers Edge Night. Click that. It'll take you through to the page that lets you know how you can get involved. Now, this could be helping send a kid to potentially their first Blazer game ever. It could be their introduction to seeing the Blazers live in person. It could be the only chance they get to see the Blazers live all season. So if you want to help out with that, don't hesitate to visit Blazers Edge and learn more about Blazers Edge Night 2015. And with that, it is my great pleasure to bring on the first guest of the podcast. This week we have Willie Reddy. He's a Blazers Edge staff writer, putting out articles every Monday morning on the site. So if you'd like to read more from him, check out Blazers Edge every Monday. He also did a couple of recaps for the site, I believe, of the Hawks and the Cavs games. So if you'd like further reading, feel free to dig those up as well. We have him on the line from Austin, Texas today. Hey, Willie, how are things going down there, bud?
Doing good. It's a beautiful day here.
Yeah, not so much here out in Beaverton. Beaverton, the suburb of Portland. I'm about 10 miles from the action, so... yeah, I'm pretty close to what's going on with the Blazers. You're a bit further away, but I assume you caught all the games last week, yeah?
Yeah, I catch most of them. Certainly miss it, but it's nice to stay connected.
Yeah, you must really like those East Coast games and those Central Time Zone games.
Yeah, it's pretty perfect because you get home from work and then the game like starts right away instead of having to wait for 6 hours or whatever it is when it's a home game.
Yeah, I feel you on the time zone difference. Those East Coast games, the 4 o'clock Pacific, 4:30 Pacific start times are pretty brutal for me. Sometimes, you know, I'm not even getting off work until after the game started. But, you know, let's go ahead and transition to talking a little bit about what you're doing at Blazers Edge. Now, you've been publishing articles every Monday. What exactly is it that you're writing about, man?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I kind of write what I like to read. Yes, you might say. So I really love all the in-depth pieces. And obviously, you know, like beat reporting, all that stuff is great. But as somebody who's been obsessed with the Blazers for a long time, and if you've seen all the games, you know, it's reading about the games and kind of play-by-plays haven't been kind of what's really drawn me in. So, I mean, I guess I try to write about the things that that go beyond that, and little things that I notice. And I guess I try to write things that I don't see in other places. So trying to figure out how to complete the conversation about a player, about an issue, something like that.
I noticed in a lot of your pieces that you're not afraid to go with the statistics, and you're not afraid to use advanced statistics. On the same note, you're not afraid to do the eyeball test either. And so I think you have two kind of camps sometimes, where you have stats dudes and then you have eyeball test dudes. And, you know, one side says the other, you know, you can't just take stats 100% and you can't take the eyeball test 100%. You have to use one to show the truth in the other, or you take like kind of an anomaly stat and then you apply the eyeball test and you see what's causing that, right? Or you see something going on weird on the court, and so you go back to the stats and you see if it backs up what you noticed with the eyeball test. Am I right? Is that kind of how you look at things?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think for me, it's I studied physics and economics in college, and so definitely come from kind of a, I don't know if you call it like a scientific method background, but to me, you know, you see something, you think you see something in a game, right? And then you can kind of think about, okay, well, if it's true, what stats would I expect to see? So like, you know, recently, I think we're going to get into it, you know, teams seem to be doubling Aldridge a lot more and crowding paint. So like, what stats would you expect to see if that were to happen? And then you can kind of go and look and see if you actually do see those stats. So, and then, you know, vice versa, you can do it where if you see a stat that looks weird, you can say like, what might be causing that to happen, and then look at. So to me, it's the most interesting thing about stats, and especially advanced stats, because they do capture so much more of the game these days, is the conversation they have with the eye test, so that you can test something you see, but also look for new things because of stats.
And I don't want to put you on the spot too much, but do you have a favorite underrated, maybe advanced stat that you think is underutilized or misutilized? And likewise, do you have a stat that you think just is kind of overused and doesn't really tell the story as often as people use it?
Well, the overused one is easy. That one's PER.
I was going to say PER for sure. I feel like that one's just...
I mean, I don't like that one at all. It's a box score stat, so it's all based on numbers that people put up, and then it's also I don't know, it's like crazy heavily weighted to rebounds, mm-hmm. and you just have big men that just dominate it. So it can be nice. So I mean, you know, the one thing is every stat kind of has its place. So I think PER is kind of like the quick and dirty. So it's a really easy way to look at a player. But with the new, and I think it's, I guess to answer your other question about underutilized stats, the regularized adjusted plus minus, mm-hmm. that ESPN has kind of just come out with, this is the first season. I mean, that's just got that's just a lot more interesting in terms of trying to rate players on an overall basis. So I think people should and will soon start using that more than PER in that kind of like who's better general question.
That's the regularized, you said, real plus minus?
Yes. So it's RAPM. So it's regularized adjusted plus minus, which essentially just means so, you know, basic plus minus, which is like, you know, that while you're on the floor, did your team score more or score less than the opponent? But obviously that's super noisy because one guy might play with the starters while another guy might play with the bench, and then, you know, playing better players or worse players, a lot of stuff. So the regularized and adjusted tries to take into account who you're playing with and who you're playing against. So that's why it's in my opinion, the best kind of like, if you were to pick one metric to try to rate players, that would be the one that I would go with.
And that's an ESPN stat. So then maybe that's Kevin Pelton. He's a friend of Blazers Edge.
Yeah. And it's, you know, a lot of people have talked about it for a while, but ESPN, I think, to my knowledge, is the first person to put it, to have it kind of like updating regularly. Mm-hmm. So there are a couple other sites and they have like different formulas and little twists on it. So I actually don't even know if you'd say ESPN is the best one, but it's the one that's most, they're the ones that made it kind of regularly available in real time.
And with statistics in mind, you mentioned earlier that you got your degree in economics. What school did you go to, man?
I went to a small school in St. Paul. It's called McAllister College.
Mm-hmm.
Go Scots.
Go Ducks. I'm from the U of O.
we were talking earlier. You're journalism, right?
Journalism major. Yeah, that's me.
That's awesome. So how did you get in touch with Blazers Edge? I'm always curious because I think, well, I assume that my experience was weird or anomalous, but you know.
Oh, wow. I'll try to make a long story short. I'd been reading Blazers Edge since probably the 2005-2006 season, so I was already checking every day. It was early spring 2013. I was wrapping up my journalism degree at the U of O, and I logged onto Blazers Edge. One day I saw Dave's listing for the game preview writer. I said, what the heck? I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to be doing after school, so I got my resume ready, sent it in. Back and forth process took probably 6-7 weeks overall. Kind of, he was just Dave and Ben Gulliver at the time were just kind of narrowing down the applicants one step at a time. So, 2-3 steps into the process, it had been a couple weeks since I had heard back from Dave, and I was kind of worried, kind of thinking that I hadn't got it. So I was starting to look at other opportunities for me following graduation. Kind of at the last second, I got an email from Dave letting me know that I was the guy they wanted to do the game previews going forward, and they announced me as the game preview writer in, I think it was early May 2013. But what I was wondering is, let's see, because you've been at Blazers Edge since the beginning of the season, and so that's probably a couple months now, I guess. It's pretty clear from reading your articles that you have a pretty solid understanding of the game of basketball, and you have a really, let's see, a natural way of communicating that on paper. And so I have kind of a two-part question for you. First, I was wondering, did you play basketball growing up? What is your relationship to the game of basketball? How did you get your understanding of it? And second, what is your background with writing? Have you written for anyone else? Have you been published at all before?
Well, with basketball, I played my whole life, essentially. Growing up, played a little bit in high school over at Prairie High School. Go Falcons.
Is that Prairie in Vancouver?
Yeah, it's kind of like Rush Prairie, so it's sort of like east side.
That's not where Dan Dickow went.
It is where Dan Dickow
went. Oh, is it?
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, he's definitely the hero of the school. But yeah, so I played my whole life. It was essentially my whole life for a long time. And then, actually, in kind of a twist of fate, I hit a growth spurt my sophomore year, which you would think is a great thing, but ended up screwing up my knees. So I ended up focusing on academics, which turned out to be a great decision. Got to go to a good college, all that stuff, and then haven't really done it competitively since. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely been a passion my whole life. And you know, it's probably pretty clear from my writing, but my favorite parts about it were always, you know, the schemes and the team concepts and the passing. I was a point guard, so I loved making passes and all that stuff. And in terms of writing, it's just, it's very minimal. I mean, school, obviously,
right?
But I don't even think I took a creative writing class my entire time in college.
Nothing? You've never been published anywhere else?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the extent of my writing was pretty much every summer I would, you know, I'd be home and bored out of my mind, and I'd just like write an article or two and put it in the fan posts. And then when I moved to Austin, you know, new place, didn't have many friends and whatnot, so I had a little bit more time, so I started writing a little bit more frequently. And then this is pretty much it. I mean, I've written a little bit. I was in a theater production that, you know, the cast kind of co-wrote the script, but you've pretty much seen most of it, so
consider me impressed, man. It's been great so far working with you at Blazers Edge. I'm looking forward to more stuff in the future as well. That said, I think it's time we move on to a little bit of Blazer talk. Let's start with the game the Saturday before last against the Washington Wizards at home. When LaMarcus Aldridge had announced that he was going to be postponing his thumb surgery and going to be playing instead of sitting out for 6 to 8 weeks. The Blazers ended up winning that game by, what was that, by 4 points?
Yeah, five, I think. 103-98, something like that.
103-96. So they won by 7 points at home against John Wall and the Washington Wizards. That game, we had LaMarcus Aldridge go off for, 26 points on 9-for-22 shooting, 9 rebounds, on a thumb that requires surgery. No one expected him to be playing for up to 2 months. And so I think, quite frankly, I think maybe just the announcement of him coming back to play and putting off the surgery, just kind of the momentum gained from that, from the depths that Blazers fans and the team were probably at prior to that game, and then leading up to the game, him announcing it, I think that probably lit a fire under everyone, and that kind of carried them, along with his amazing performance, it carried him.
Yeah.
It carried the team against the Wizards, and the Wizards had no time to prepare for Aldridge because they were preparing for a game without Aldridge, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've seen that a couple times, where just the emotional energy from a guy coming back. I mean, Willis Reed, his famous game that's always on ESPN Classics, and even for the Blazers, Brandon Roy coming back in that Suns game, was that 3-4 years ago in the playoffs? I mean, neither of those guys really did much in the game, but assuming my memory is correct, but, just the boost to the team, certainly palpable. And then, for Aldridge to give the team that momentum and then also play like he did, I mean, it was just probably one of his most memorable performances of his career, I would say.
That was Roy against the Suns back in, 08?
Yeah.
8 days after knee surgery. I mean, I think, but the story remains true that while they won that, I think they may have won the initial game with him coming back, just kind of the emotional uplifting mm-hmm. of having your leader. But they lost that series. What was it? Did they lose it 4-2? I think so.
Yeah, that was one of the only games they won. But
and so since
I'll remember that for forever.
Since Aldridge came back, they benefited from that, emotional uplift and having their leader back and showing that. That kind of leadership on the floor, on and off the floor. And then you get to the next three games. and, quite frankly, they weren't all terrible for four quarters. It wasn't 48 minutes of awful basketball.
For sure.
If you look at that Cavs game, LeBron James was announced right up to the game that he wasn't going to play. So you thought, oh, the Blazers have a solid chance on the road to steal one. From I think they had won 7 in a row at the time, and so that would have been a nice streak for the Blazers to snap. But the Cavaliers ended up pulling away 99-94, and Aldridge scored 38 points in that game, 10-for-10 free throws, 13-for-23 shooting, and 11 boards.
I'm still mad.
Only 2 turnovers. Did you cover the recap for that game?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, I think when I was reading that, I kind of noticed, I could sense it in your writing tone, another wasted performance by LA. But really, you have to take your hat off to Kyrie Irving. 55 points is pretty amazing. And, I was kind of wondering, what was it, the Blazers' defense, or was it just a ridiculous night by Irving?
It's funny if you think about kind of how games relate to one another, because, the Blazers' defensive kind of identity is that, stay at home, almost dare the ball handler in the pick and roll to shoot, by saying we're going to drop back, we're going to take away the roll, we're going to give you, we've been doing a better job of not giving so much space kind of off the pick, but still, that's kind of what the team is designed to do. And Kyrie, I mean, in the first game against the Cavs, it was all ISO ball, and, the Cavs really struggled to score, and that was with LeBron. And then, this time around, it was all ISO ball, and Kyrie just went crazy. So, I mean, it's it's tough, and you almost want the team to be able to have that flexibility to double and treat Kyrie like teams have been treating, you know, Damian these last few games, where, you know, the Hawks and the Bucks both have those kind of really aggressive trapping defenses. But, you know, it's just tough, especially when that kind of performance happens against a particular style of defense that is what it is.
Well, you got to look at it from kind of a top down or a bottom up approach. So if the wings are going to be giving extra attention to a perimeter player like Kyrie, doesn't that mean in your front court defense you have to have the kind of defenders that can erase mistakes?
Yeah, or even just not even so much mistakes, because if you're planning to do them, they're not really mistakes. But, you know, like, they have to be able to make those rotations and those weak side helps. And that's why the Blazers defense is the way it is. I mean, the biggest team in the world, I think, unless there's some like Lithuanian teams that just support like 6-7-footers or something. But certainly the biggest in the NBA. I think on a random note, Kentucky is the second biggest team. Like the University of Kentucky is the second biggest team in the country, which is
professional and college.
Yeah.
Oh, so, wow. Well,
there's that. But
it's no wonder they have 7 first rounders or whatever it is.
Yeah, it's crazy. But yeah, I mean, you gotta think that the Blazers. I mean, I'll write about it tomorrow. The Blazers' offense has really been what's killed them the past 3 games. Not so much their defense.
Okay, well, let's. We got the Cavs, Kyrie going off for 55 in a game where Kevin Love scored, what, 10 points? He shot 3-for-15. J.R. Smith shot 1-for-6 from deep. Tristan Thompson, 2-for-7. Amon Shumpert scored 4 points. So you literally had no one but Kyrie Irving doing anything. I shouldn't say literally, but. No one really was able to produce much besides Kyrie, and that kind of overshadowed Aldridge's 38 points. And then you have Friday's game against the Hawks. Now, I had sat down to write that Thursday afternoon, and mind you, this was following the announcement that Lillard wasn't going to be on the All-Star team this year. And let's just say I did buy a bit into the hype. I didn't think that Lillard would change the way that he played. I didn't think that he would I didn't think he would change his style. I didn't think he was going to be shooting from 30 feet, you know, constantly, or just pulling up or trying to create too much on his own. But I thought he would be motivated, and I thought he'd be a bit frustrated, and I thought maybe this would be a good opportunity for him to bounce back from quite frankly what's been maybe the roughest stretch of his career, 5-6 games offensively. Sure. At least.
Mm-hmm.
He ended up scoring 13 points on 6-for-20 shooting. I mean, I should point out that he picked up 11 assists, which was really solid. It was actually pretty nice to see him being able to pass the ball to his teammates that well. A lot of that might have had to do with Aldridge shooting 15-for-24 and putting in 37 points.
Yeah, and he also had 6 turnovers, if I remember correctly.
6 turnovers as well. So yeah, he was, I guess, 11 assists gets kind of balanced out with 6 turnovers, but to see him being such a willing passer like that and being able to find his teammates and maybe dial back the turnovers a bit, but it's never a bad thing to see Dame be an aggressive passer. What exactly happened in that game that you noticed offensively or defensively?
Yeah, well, I mean, like, that's, you know, just to go back to kind of team styles again and defensive schemes, the Hawks and actually the Bucks played sort of similarly, where they do the same thing the Bulls do in the sense that they kind of force guys away from the screen, but then instead of dropping the big back like the Blazers, they trap. And so it's really tough to get to score on them in kind of the first thrust of the offense, because that first thrust, as you go around the screen, you know, you're doubled. So the way you score against Atlanta, and the reason they're like a fourth best defense in the league, something like that, is you have to swing the ball around or, you know, pass out of that double team. And so, you know, when Dame was doubled, he got those passes out to Aldridge, and he was able to score. But the spacing and the ability of the other wings on the weak side to make the Hawks pay for doing that, for doubling Dame has been a struggle kind of all year. I actually remember a specific play. I think I put it in my recap that Korver was guarding Batum, and he completely just like broke the whole defensive system and just left Batum wide open to go double, and I think it was Lillard or Aldridge in the paint, and kicked it out, and Batum made the three, and Korver just looks over at his bench and shrugs, and just this like, oh man, I can't believe he made it look, and he was just, you know, baffling to see that done. I mean, that's what people do to Tony Allen, yeah. Right? Like, and they were doing it to Batum. So, I mean, it's been, you know, it's definitely Lillard is struggling. He's been in a huge slump. He's missing even his open shots. But there's a whole team thing going on about, you know, passing and spacing and being able to burn teams and keep defenses honest. That's more out of balance than I've ever seen it since Stotts kind of came to the team.
Yeah, I think I noticed in the same recap that you're referencing that you said that the Los Angeles Clippers had kind of set out the blueprint for how to disrupt Portland's offense, and particularly Lillard. So what exactly is the philosophy behind the defense that teams like the Hawks, the Clippers, and the Bucks are doing against Portland right now?
Yeah, so I mean, I think every defense is kind of sets up a struggle, and the different styles of defense, you want to pick the struggle that you think you can win most often. So like with the Blazers, they have so much size. You know, the struggle that they set up is we're gonna stay home on shooters. We're gonna drop back, and we're gonna see if you can, if your point guard and your if the two guys involved in the pick and roll can beat our two defenders. We're gonna make it that two-on-two game, and then, you know, they're helping a little bit more off the weak side than they have in the past, which has helped, but that's kind of the struggle that the Blazers defense sets up. When the Clippers or the Bucks or Atlanta, you know, when they trap and they bring those guys up, that's really, you know, setting up a struggle of can you pass out of these double teams faster than we can rotate. Mm-hmm. And so that has been, I think, probably Lillard's and the team's biggest weakness right now in terms of on offense, because I mean that's what to an even more ramped up degree what Miami used to do when kind of the LeBron Miami teams, and the teams that, you know, beat them had figured out ways to kind of use that frenetic motion against them. So you would see, you know, like Manu Ginobili in the finals, instead of trying to go around screens, you would have these what are called escape dribbles, where you plant. So you are going forward, you plant, and you kind of have a step back. It's almost like a step back jumper, except you don't shoot a jumper, you just kind of step back. And with those escape dribbles, you're able to set up passing lanes around the perimeter, and then move the ball faster than the Heat players could get there. And, you know, they had so many open threes and all that stuff. So I mean, it's those, as a team, and, you know, Lillard in particular, it's those escape dribbles, it's those, you know, how to get, not only get the pass there, but get it there on time and on target, that really are the, like, you know, the half step differences that get Wesley a wide open shot versus a contested three. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely a big thing that the Blazers need to work on. But I mean, the nice thing is they have all the pieces to do so. I mean, having Aldridge is such a luxury because he's able to shoot from so far out. You know, he gives lots of passing angles that other bigs can't do. I mean, he's a willing passer. And then once Batum gets back and, you know, all that stuff, we have such good shooters on the weak side and everybody's healthy that, you know, they can definitely get there. It's not a fundamental problem. It's just something that they have to tighten up.
I think Blazer fans initially saw this in what was maybe the fifth game of the season or so against the Golden State Warriors, in that loss where they had the lead in the final minute and just kind of the execution down the stretch kind of gave the game over to the Warriors. And I think you saw Damian Lillard getting doubled in the last couple of possessions, and he could not dribble out of it. He couldn't find a teammate to pass to, and it ended up, I believe it ended up creating a turnover.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's lots of different examples. I mean, like, you know, the other thing to just keep in mind is that, you know, we're talking about Atlanta, Milwaukee, Golden State. They're what,
3, 4, and 5 or something, 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, something like that. So, I mean, it's not like the Blazers are the only team that struggle with this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially the length of Milwaukee, you know, last night was something that was really bothered the Blazers. So this is not something that only the Blazers struggle with, but it's definitely something that if they're going to beat any of those teams in the playoffs, definitely need to tighten up their spacing, tighten up their passing, and also, you know, Lillard needs to play more under control.
I think what we're seeing now is that when these teams put on the extra pressure on LA and Damian, what's happening is the tertiary scorers for the Blazers, like Wesley Matthews, Nick Batum, they're just not creating from those open shots that they are getting.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, Batum is tough because, I mean, his wrist is... I mean, obviously, we don't know the extent of the injury and how it's affecting his shooting, but, you know, that Korver kind of anecdote about treating him like, you know, Tony Allen spent a bunch of years in the league being a complete negative on offense, and it took him years to learn how to, like, when to cut, where to cut, how he could move around the court in such a way that he could be dangerous, even if he couldn't shoot very well. So, I mean, Batum, you know, it's one thing to say, oh, if he can't shoot, he should still be more active. But that, like, I think people don't understand necessarily how difficult that is, because you have to be active in very specific ways. You have to make very specific cuts that fit in with the rest of the team and are actually helpful. And, I mean, he's always been a good shooter, so he's never had to learn that. So it's not something he can just, you know, adjust on the fly. And then Wesley, you know, I think for me, Wesley hasn't played that much worse than normal. It's just he's been a little predictable. Mm-hmm. So he's not curling as much to the rim. He's not cutting to the hoop as much. And so his defender kind of knows where he's going to be, so that when he helps against Lillard, helps against Aldridge, he knows exactly where Wesley is spotting up around the perimeter and can close out and take away that shot easier. But it's also, you know, the passes haven't been as crisp around the perimeter and out of those double teams. So he's getting it a half second, a full second later than he normally would, and those shots have been more contested and more difficult. So it's all connected, and, you know, one guy's struggle makes the next guy's job more difficult, and then you know, it's kind of, I guess, what I've always called, like, the chaos theory of basketball, and that, you know, one small thing makes the next thing more difficult, which makes the next thing more difficult, and then you have, you know, the whole offense suffers because you're not doing these three little tiny things right.
Yeah, it's hard for Batum, I guess, to keep the defense honest when he literally is playing through a sprained wrist on his shooting wrist, no less.
Yeah.
And so the defender, if I'm getting this correctly, is able to sag off a little bit. And so he's not he's getting his open shot, but he can't hit that. But if you have a defender sagging off into the passing lane, that's going to make life more difficult for him to move the ball around and set up his teammates, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, Batum's guy is making it more difficult to score in the paint. It's also making it more difficult to pass to other shooters who can actually hit things. I mean, it all fits together. And you know, the Blazers have been so lucky the whole kind of Stotts era, I guess you could say, of having just, you know, everybody could shoot. Mm-hmm. Maybe with the exception of Barton. But, you know, his minutes have always been pretty low. So it's a pretty new experience for Blazer fans to see, you know, what happens to the spacing and the beautiful movement of Stotts' offense when, you know, there's somebody who's not kind of forcing teams, to be honest.
Well, let's talk on a little more positive note, because three losses in a row, Batum's injuries, Dame's struggles, Wesley Matthews' struggles, that's all kind of front and center right now. But I think we're going to be able to get some silver lining here from the Blazers' current lack of depth, particularly up front. I think earlier on in the season, when Batum got hurt, Alan Crabb was able to step in, and he actually showed quite a few nice things. And then he was in and out. He was actually in the rotation for a number of games. And then Stotts just kind of stopped going to him off the bench after he tweaked his knee, I think, in a game. And since then, he just hasn't really played. But it was nice to kind of see a guy like Crabb get on the court and see what he could actually do. And then you have Myers Leonard, who, for all intents and purposes, has come out and shown that he's an NBA player and that he can be an effective player in a front court rotation. And so I think there might be a bit of a logjam in the front court when Robin Lopez and Joel Freeland get healthy, because you're going to have those two. You're going to have LaMarcus Aldridge, Thomas Robinson at the power forward spot, and then Myers Leonard at the hybrid 4-5 spot, I guess. And then Darrell Wright, I suppose, as a stretch four at times. So you have a pretty deep front court there. What do you see for Myers Leonard's future with the Blazers when the front court is entirely healthy?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a really good question. I do, in the interest of silver linings, just want to say one quick thing. In that, you know, like, all those little things that are going wrong right now are, you know, the team has the talent and the people to make those go right. And so this is definitely a slump. It's a team-wide slump, but they're gonna start playing better even with Nick's wrist injury. So Blazer fans, relax. We got, 10 games on the Thunder, and yeah, the offense is going to get going again. There's just way too much talent for it to be this bad for much longer. But yeah, I mean, Myers Leonard has been, I don't know, is revelation too strong of a word?
Not considering his performances his first two seasons, I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, I called him Big Dirk in a recent article, and his shooting numbers are seriously Dirkian. And he's still not, I mean, he still looks awkward on defense because his timing's a little bit off on, like, block shots, and doesn't change directions all that quickly. But, I mean, he's in the right spots most of the time now. And, you know, just being how big he is, that's going to go a long way. So, I don't know. I guess when everybody comes back, I would imagine it to be similar to the way it was at the beginning of the season, where you kind of had your set guys, and then, Robinson or Freeland or Wright would only play if kind of the matchup was right, which is a good place to be, because, I mean, I think you've kind of seen it, especially in Milwaukee, where, you know, Stotts tried Myers for 8 minutes, and then he tried Darrell, and then he tried Thomas, and he's just essentially keeps trying all these different things and trying them in spots where they wouldn't necessarily be the right fit. And so, you know, just getting back to that kind of core is going to let him use those guys, not when he has to, but when he wants to. But yeah, I mean, he's been a revelation. I think his trade value just went sky high. I mean, not sky high, but he actually has a trade value now. And then, I don't think he's done enough to take Freeland's spot or anything that drastic. But that assumes Freeland comes back and plays like he did before his injury, which, as we've seen, may not be the case.
Last year, he kind of got lost in the shuffle when he was coming back from that knee injury, but. We'll see what happens this year. I think for Leonard, maybe we could see a bit more time at the four spot. Do you see Myers Leonard being able to take over some of those backup power forward minutes, or is that going to be something that Myers Leonard is going to be filling in along with the center position as a reserve?
I mean, I guess my perception of the rotation was, you know, Rolo and Aldridge, and then Kamen and Freeland off the bench. I think both, you know, Myers and Freeland are kind of that 4-5. And that's honestly, you know, like the other nice thing that Chris Kamen doesn't really get credit for is that, you know, he's a pretty rare breed to be a what you might call a true center, but still have, you know, the 17-footer, to still have the post-up game. There aren't too many guys like that, and that allows the Blazers to play, you know, someone who might be a traditional five. Well, Myers is anything but a traditional five, but, you know, allows him to play like a guy like Joel Freeland, who's kind of offensively in his game is more of a center role, allows them to play Freeland at the four spot, which kind of then gives them an extra boost on defense because now you've got two defensive-minded big people. So, I mean, I think, and you've seen it with, you know, Robin Lopez playing with Chris Kaman. Chris Kaman really lets them play almost anybody they want, really, off the bench with Kaman. So, to me, it's really like you got your three bigs, you got Aldridge, Lopez, and Kaman when healthy, and then any of the other guys can fit in because of the skills of those other players, which is a really nice luxury to have.
So, if we're talking about all the reserves in general, do you have kind of an outlook or a forecast for them for the rest of the season?
Yeah, outlook in terms of their play or like their future with the team or both?
Not long-term future, but let's say getting toward the spring, getting toward the playoffs. How do you see this rotation kind of working out, assuming close to full health?
And no trades.
We'll touch on that in a minute.
I guess. So, you know, the whole thing about this year is that it's not about seeding, it's about matchups in the West, because top to bottom, they're all, maybe the exception of Phoenix, you know, just a really, really good team. So, I mean, I think you'll see that in the game. You kind of have, you know, as far as teams go, you have versatility both kind of within players and between players. So, you know, Aldridge has gotten, you know, definitely some credit he's deserved for being as mobile and as big as he is, which gives the team a lot of versatility, you know, just with him on the floor. But, you know, the fact that, you know, both Thomas and Myers and Durrell and Freeland are all, you know, have shown that they're good enough to be playable, you know, that gives him the ability to pick and choose. So I guess, at least in the front court, I definitely see Freeland getting a spot back. And then I see the other two guys being used depending. I think you could see Myers Leonard play most of the series against like the Clippers, say, because that you know Freeland Hawes matchup is pretty interesting. Or not Freeland, sorry, the Myers Hawes matchup is pretty interesting. And then I think you could see, you know, Thomas Robinson play almost the entire next series against, I don't know, maybe Memphis, or I have to think about that some more. And in terms of the wings are a struggle right now, man.
Yeah, it seems like Stotts has been kind of piecemealing his rotation all season with the wings, just kind of riding the hot hand, or as opposed to riding the hot hand, rather maybe he's kind of just putting the cold hand on the bench.
Yeah, I would go with that one. Man, I mean, I keep wanting, CJ keeps showing flashes, and I want him to just grab it, but he is, he obviously hasn't figured out how to finish in the paint, which wouldn't be a problem if he would stop going in there, and then, you know, he can get by his man so easily, and he can get a good shot so easily that he, in many ways, is rightfully, you know, like taking those shots, but he's just shooting just really poorly. I've talked about his defense a little bit, and I think he deserves a ton of credit for that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the quick hands, right? Like Wesley Matthews kind of taught him that.
Mm-hmm. His hands are better. His feet are a lot better. He's just on balance way more. And I mean, I think he's one of our better perimeter defenders. And he's nice in that he's in many ways, you know, very different from Wesley Matthews in how he defends, because Wesley is, you know, big, strong, tough, but you know, maybe not as quick laterally as you would want against a guy like Monta Ellis or something like that. Whereas CJ is almost the opposite. You know, he's a little undersized, can get bullied a little bit, but he really fights around screens and stays with his man, and stays in front of his man really well. He still gets Lou Williams. The last time I saw, you know, CJ, I noticed something about his defense. Lou Williams got him on a bunch of head fakes and one of these stupid fouls. So he's still making rookie mistakes, but kind of the fundamental athleticism is there to be, I think, an above average defender, which I never would have guessed when he first came into the league. And Allen, I have no idea what happened to Allen. I mean, I thought when he started, I was shocked, and then he played very solid. He's long. His closeouts might be the best on the team. And he's shooting 40%. So, I mean, he seems like exactly the guy that the Blazers need right now. Barton and CJ have just been so bad. I can't imagine that if Allen Crabbe was playing well in practice and all those types of things, that Stotts wouldn't be giving him a shot. So hopefully he gets back, because the Blazers could really use another 6'6 guy, plays good defense, and can hit a three on the weak side.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we could talk about Jarrell Wright a little bit. He's been playing some small forward, also a bit of stretch four.
Yeah, I mean, he's been doing both, I think. I mean, he played a lot of stretch four in the Atlanta game. I actually thought that was a big reason the Blazers lost, was he got torched in that matchup with Mike Scott. I can't decide on Jarrell. I think I'm one of the few people that's like pretty down on him as a fit for the Blazers, just because the thing that makes Batum so important to the team is his ability to run a pick and roll, make those secondary passes. And to me, when I see Jarrell play, I mean, he's got that real nasty pump fake.
Nasty in a good way or nasty?
Nasty in a good way, yeah. so he'll get guys in the air a bunch, and then, we'll try like a one dribble pull up, but that's not a very consistent shot. Or he'll take these kind of slow, jerky drives, and then so many times, the defense just resets on those things. So I think Jarrell is certainly not bad to have, but I think the Blazers can get a lot better. Just based on, a guy that can not only hit the three like Jarrell is doing, but can also pump fake and then do something with that. Because, that whole thing that we were talking about the weak side and not being able to burn teams that double Lillard is, the inability of a lot of the wings to attack closeouts and then make the passes back out to the perimeter. So, you have Dame drive, he gets doubled, kicks to the perimeter, everybody sprints out, pump fake, get him in the air, and then attack the hoop again. Like, that being able to score off that attack the hoop again is something the Blazers have been missing lately, especially on the bench. So it would be, put me in the we can do better than Jarrell camp. Although he certainly is nice to have compared to some of our other options right now.
Yeah, and you really could do worse than Jarrell Wright as the seventh or eighth man in your rotation. But Willie, I know we teased a bit of trade talk earlier on in the podcast. We're not going to have time to get to that today. However, I did want to extend an invitation for you to come back anytime in the future, and I wanted to thank you for being on this week's edition with me.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, you take care, Willie.
All right, Rip City, baby.
All right, that's going to do it for the February 3rd edition of the Blazers Edge podcast. Thank you for listening. Make sure to tune in next Tuesday. You can hear Phil Nasons and Dave Deckard in their normal slot. I'll be releasing my episode toward the end of the week.